This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
This is The 11th Hour. I'm Páraic Branagh. Welcome to this week's selection from The 11th Hour podcast. An exhibition with the mysterious title, The Secret Theory of Drawing, opened at the Model Arts and Nyland Gallery in Sligo last week and runs till March the 18th. In a few moments, artist Jesse Jones and art collector Tom Honan will tell us what they thought about the exhibition. But first, let's hear from the curator of the exhibition, Caoimhín MacGillalay. Caoimhín joined me in the 11th Hour studio earlier today, and I begin by asking him to put the title of the exhibition, which was inspired by the artist David Austin, into context for me.
Well, the secret theory of drawing is actually a resonant and quite suggestive phrase, but it was a misheard phrase that David Austin, who's an old friend of mine and a very good artist, and as it happens, has got close connections with the drawing room where this in London where this show kicked off. He once misheard this in a loud pub, I think, in a conversation with other artists, one of whom he thought said something about the secret theory of drawing. And in fact, he made a small abstract work of the type he often makes where he uses these phrases he finds in novels and so forth, on which is printed the secret theory of drawing. I happen to own it. It's lived in my hallway for a few years. And when the drawing room invited me to curate a show, and I was chatting with David, as I say, who's got close connections with the drawing room, we suddenly remembered this work, and I thought, well, let's spin something out of this. Take the show's cue from this misheard and potentially misleading quotation and look at a particular type of drawing, or non-drawing almost, or range of works that relate to drawing, that are rather different than the type of drawing you see everywhere now in art exhibitions in Britain, Europe. Drawing's big now in a way it wasn't 4 or 5 years ago. So this is a slightly more oblique take on drawing in contemporary art.
So the line or drawing is the basis of all art. Mm-hmm. Where does the line feature in this exhibition? Does it come off the wall, or does it go onto the floor, or where does it go?
Well, you're quite right. I mean, the notion of line is quite basic to drawing. There's another, I mean, the notion of the grid, especially in 20th century modern art, you know, is quite central. So these aspects, and the notion of the graph, and if you make a line or a squiggle, then, you know, if it suddenly becomes meaningful, you repeat it, then suddenly you've got something approaching a language, like Oriental ideograms. And all these aspects of drawing are in the show. But they might actually be realised in the form of a sculpture, which is effectively a drawing in space using line. Like the work, there's one work by Bojan Sarcevic, which just looks like it might be some weird calligram adrift from some unfathomable language. But effectively, it's just a small, beautiful bronze sculpture, thin filaments of bronze with a little thread between. There's another work which is photographic. It looks from a distance, bank of eight photographs, it just looks like a drawing. And you think, what are these funny patterns? They look like some code, as if it was some written version of Morse code. But in fact, they're just moths congregating in the corner of a brightly lit room. So these, I mean, there's an air of, I hope, sort of, you know, seductiveness and mystery about these works, which tease us into imagining we can make some sense of them as sometimes linguistic representations, as some form of code, a secret theory, if you like. But it's very elusive.
But the secret theory was your starting point. How did you pull all the artists together? Did you sort of like take one, your painting in your hallway, the drawing in your hallway, and say what relates to that?
It was a little more fluid than that, in a sense. I think the drawing room asked me to curate this show because I've known them for some years and they've known the artists I've worked with.
Give us the background on the drawing room.
The drawing room is a small but highly regarded, I think, independent, publicly funded gallery in the East End of London, which over the last 4 or 5 years have been mounting a lot of really interesting shows on a fairly modest budget, should be said, which address drawing. You know, sometimes very directly they have straightforward drawing shows, and in other times like this show, they'll have, you know, looked at drawing in relation to sound art and so forth. So they asked me to do the show, and rather than actually gather together a lot of young London artists, which is what happens quite often in their space, understandably, it's in the heart of a city where there are many, many artists, I just gradually thought of those artists I really admire, many of whom are close friends from a really broad range of both generations. It goes back to Brian O'Doherty, who has been working since the mid-50s, to a lot of artists of my own generation from everywhere, from hailing from Albania to California, from Scotland to France, and looked at aspects of their work that mightn't be what they're best known for, but that had some resonance in terms of this starting point, this almost arbitrary starting point, this little abstract painting that says the secret theory of drawing.
Are you trying to challenge the audience to look at drawing differently?
Well, Because, as I said, just for the last few years, these things come and go, and they're, you know, they're cycles of fashion in many ways. Drawing of that sort of intense, gestural, confessional, bedsit, mad sort of variety is everywhere. So this is a lot more oblique. This is a lot more suggestive. It's a lot less instant. It's a lot less autonomous and complete of itself as a picture, each one of these. So I suppose they were the things I was looking for. Drawing, as I say, drawing or making lines with rope on ground, through photographic means, through sculptural means, text even. There's a sort of quite a teasing contribution by Douglas Gordon, who's very well known for film works, but not so well known for drawing, called The Daily Practice of Drawing. But it's entirely possible that this suggestion that he draws every day is every bit as misleading as the title that we started the exhibition with.
So in some ways the artists in this exhibition are looking conceptually and theoretically at drawing.
Well, I suppose some of the artists would be really sort of slap bang in the middle of that grouping that are usually called conceptual artists. Others, like Ellen Gallagher, is pretty well known as a painter. Others are well known as sculptors or filmmakers there. I suppose there's this conceptual act. I mean, if it's possible to imagine any art that doesn't have some conceptual aspect, I suppose most of these artists would be closer to that lineage that kicks off in the late 1960s and early 70s, and which we now call conceptual art. And indeed, two of the elder statesmen, if you like, of the show, Brian O'Doherty, better known as Patrick Ireland since the 70s, and John Latham, who was a sort of grand old man of English conceptual art and just died a year or two ago, they would actually have been of that original generation. But most of the artists, I think the average age of the artists here are around about in their late 30s, and they would have been of that generation who in many ways looked back to conceptual art, the heyday of the late 60s and early 70s, to find something new, relevant to the contemporary, that might inform their practice. So I suppose there would be.
Can you see progression from, say, work like Brian Doherty's in the 70s to later? Can you see his influence on later artists? He was a very, very strong influence on
drawing. Well, he's a very strong influence in many ways. I mean, Brian O'Doherty, under his original name, if you like, is probably best known as the writer of a series of essays called Beyond the White Cube. You know, I mean, the notion of the White Cube as describing the classic gallery space more or less didn't exist until he wrote those famous essays in the 70s. So his thinking informs not just the way people make art now, but the way people like me end up putting it in rooms and displaying it, the way audiences expect to see an array of contemporary art in a modern gallery space, which wasn't always the case. We just take it for granted when we walk into a spare white room with lots of space between works. Not unlike the exhibition as it was in London and as it is now in the model. So his thinking, for example, very wide-ranging, not just in the terms of practice itself. But yes, work, an artist like John Latham, the other artist in the show, who produced in the early 70s a number of one-second drawings. How do you reduce this notion of drawing to the smallest, most absolutely concentrated form? You splash a blank piece of white board with a spatter of ink, black ink, and there you have a drawing. Or do you? At least you have the minimum means by which you might execute a drawing. And again, building on that, artists have I mean, this is part of their heritage, I suppose, and it realises in different ways. Olafur Eliasson, who's best, also in the show, probably best known to everybody for that huge exhibition and huge work in the Turbine Hall, the Tate, last year, where he more or less recreated an entire sun by artificial means and clouds, smoke and mirrors on a grand scale. But here we have this tiny set of drawings he made that looks like he made them by hand, but no, they're made by a handmade drawing machine brought out onto his father's fishing boat. He's from of Danish Icelandic origin, and he allowed the rocking of the boat to generate the drawing. So this notion of making a drawing, which is effectively a seascape, but by really contemporary means. And yes, the generation of Brian O'Doherty and John Latham really would have opened up that range of possibilities for an artist like Olafur Eliasson, at least in this aspect of his work.
And that was the curator of the exhibition, Caoimhe MacGillalay, art critic, former Turner Prize judge, and lecturer in UCD's School of Irish, Celtic Studies, Irish Folklore and Linguistics. I'm joined now in the studio by artist Jesse Jones and by art collector Tom Honan, who have both been to see The Secret Theory of Drawing. Jesse Jones, what do you think of the title of the exhibition? Did it relate to the work featured in the exhibition?
Well, I love secrets, so it was an immediate kind of seduction to want to find out what the secret was and to try and decode it. I'm a big fan of Lost, so I mean, I can sustain this kind of wanting to find out more and kind of pull at that thread. But in a way, it could have been called a secret theory of language, you know. There was so much references to language within the show, so it was not just about drawing the way we would usually think about drawing as these Churascura Renaissance drawings or drawings as finished pieces, but more so as well drawing connections between the artists, that none of the works were, like Cuivín says, autonomous. They linked in with each other and kind of showed the interconnections between all the different artists and different thoughts that were going through, and also between the different generations of artists, because there would have been this thing of artists from different generations, and how there is this idea of a game played by artists of different generations, which Duchamp talked about. This is definitely present in the show.
Tell us a bit about the Duchamp thing.
Well, that Duchamp piece is amazing. It's probably one of my favourite artworks, but I mean, it's by Patrick Ireland. It's by Brian O'Doherty, Patrick Ireland, but it's a cardiograph of a heartbeat. And Brian O'Doherty studied medicine in UCD around the corner. So there's this kind of relationship between science and medicine and art, which had somehow historically ruptured. But this artwork was kind of an interesting way of... It came about because Duchamp had said in passing to Patrick Ireland, O'Doherty, that when something enters a gallery, it dies. It becomes a mausoleum. Nothing can live inside a gallery. It's all dead. So O'Doherty took a cardiograph. Obviously, he had the patient-doctor confidentiality and trust going on there. But he took a cardiograph of Duchamp's heartbeat and showed it to him. And there was this moment that he must have had some serious existential crisis as to whether or not he would flatline if he agreed that it was dead, you know? So...
that piece is central to the exhibition, Tom.
Yes, I mean it is. I mean you walk in and the first space you see Cathy Wilkes, the piece of the sculptural piece, which is a found object, effectively a derelict radiator, and I mean that takes you. I mean it's basically Duchamp's urinal, really, in a different guise, if you like, and that you're taken from that along. Various developments, and you get to Patrick Ireland and you're back to Duchamp again in relation to the heartbeat. So there is, yes, there is it's a very connected exhibition in relation to what's happening. It works as an exhibition in terms of a whole collection of pieces. It has to be said that each individual piece, in its own isolation, you might have difficulty existing as an art piece, in my view.
They all support each other, so to say.
Yes, they all support each other, and they're all. I mean, there is a theme. I mean, obviously, we know now it isn't. It's random drawing. It's accidental drawing. It's accidental line. There's nothing deliberate in a lot of the work, except maybe in the more representational pieces like Ellen Gallagher, which is a gorgeous, one of my favourite pieces, because it's a very accessible piece. It's very large painting on paper, imposed on canvas, and it draws you in. There's one section, it's grid-like, and there's a rectangular piece in the middle which is darker, which sucks you in, and it's a very representational piece. It's an easy piece, but I think it fits well with the other pieces that are there, which are less accessible. Some of them are. That was one of my favourite pieces, and the Cathy Wilkes.
This is the radiator.
The radiator, which is basically, it's in the it's really it's created in the shape of a body. You have the wooden pieces, elongated wooden pieces, and the structure is loosely female. It's certainly human, and it's of found objects. Now it's funny. I normally wouldn't be drawn to a piece like that, but it's a piece that, as I went through the exhibition, I kept coming back to, and I found very amusing. Now it's cordoned off to avoid the children from
tripping over it or
dismantling it or whatever. But it actually is a very interesting piece, and there is a continuity in the show. But as I say, some of the pieces on their own would have difficulty, in my view, existing as works of art.
So the sum of the parts makes a great whole exhibition, Jessie?
Well, I suppose, but as well as that, I mean, because you have historical works like the Brian O'Doherty work and you have contemporary works, they do kind of add to this conversation that's happening over generations about what inextricably is connected between the art practice and I suppose the everyday as a location for how we can understand art and how it can be broken down to atomic gestures, as in these 1 second drawings. But as regards language, I mean, with the Dominique González Forrester, we see this neon type, which is like a kind of Mandarin type for a meaning that we don't yet understand or we can't understand.
It's a symbol of confusion.
Like a symbol, like. Yeah. But I mean, it raises a lot of interesting questions in terms of how we can geographically grow up in one particular geographic location, but we enter this global shared culture, and that kind of lack of understanding of knowledge and language of how we can communicate with each other. And I suppose, you know, it kind of references in a way how Western youth culture has adopted Japanese language in terms of tattoos and things like that, and they seem to be dislocated and they seem to have dematerialised what their meaning originally was about. But I actually find the Ellen Gallagher work quite difficult because, it looks like it's a pink sheets of paper with lines of going across it like a grid, like as if that's how you'd learn handwriting when you're a child, or like office flashcards that haven't been written on yet. So they have this kind of moment before language comes into existence and inability to communicate. And from Ellen Gallagher's previous work, which revolves around racial identities and questions how we stereotype racial identities, this work, because it lacks language, seems to speak of that inability to speak competently of these issues. But yet, when the mediation material comes into play, that kind of is thrown back on its head because it can be reduced to kind of the paper is pink, referencing Caucasian skin colour, which, I mean, to me is an oversimplification of what is a really interesting.
Of an eye in the middle of the piece.
Which is it's a really interesting work about that.
I must say, I've only seen these images in catalogues, of course, but I found them very, very strong. You said it was unified. You said that the sum was greater, the parts were greater together than they would be separately. Yeah. How was it like would it be an education experience, say, for a student to go in there to see the history of a conceptual drawing?
I personally, if I'm going to any exhibition, I go there out of pure interest. It's important to see, if you can, see the positive in every exhibition. That's important. However, I think one little criticism I'd like to make about it is that it's important to make a show accessible to the public who go in to see it. And in a certain sort of way, there's unnecessary camouflage exercised in this.
In what way?
In relation to the title, quite simply. The other issue is, I think it might help if we had some semblance of confirmation as to what the artist was aspiring to. Leaving aside what we might make of a piece of work ourselves, I think it would be nice to know what the artist himself or herself was actually saying.
Now, this obviously, catalogue information you're looking for here, is it?
Well, no, I'm looking for a certain entree for the public who walk in the door, who perhaps don't know anything about any of the artists. And in relation to the introduction in the two-page catalogue, it sets out the semblance of what's happening, but in language which is, I think,
adds to the confusion. Justin?
I think it's unnecessarily convoluted. Know. That's my own view, and I don't mean to be critical.
Are being critical, sir.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I am, but I'm just basically calling it as it is, and I just feel that the work is good, but I think you can't presume that everybody has the CV of every artist that's in the show, and I think to the public walking in the door in Sligo, a little help for.
It was too mysterious, Jesse, was it?
Well, I don't know whether we should kind of judge whether an artist's intention having been fulfilled is the success or failure of an artwork. I think in a lot of ways that sometimes a lot of the works are about failure to communicate and failure to understand how to communicate, and that in turn would communicate how there is a failure to communicate with the public and to communicate with each other. So the artworks kind of set up a type of dialogue with each other that is about language and communication, and kind of circulates as you're walking through the show as a type of rumour or Chinese whisper, that one piece is kind of whispering to the next. But I do see your point, but I would kind of argue that, you know, if people don't understand it, they should question it. I mean, there would have been things that after seeing the show, I went back and questioned and done a bit of research around and found really interesting things. So there is this sense of the show challenge it to unearth things that you take as a given, you take for granted about the gallery space and you take for granted about the artwork. I mean, in Douglas Gordon's work, the everyday practice of John is a series of envelopes with obviously referencing 70s mail art with this kind of mechanical register of type on each envelope, and on each envelope it says the greatest drawing ever made, the greatest drawing ever unmade. But all of this is about, like, is the envelope the drawing or is the drawing inside the envelope? And it kind of questions whether we have to see something directly visually to believe it exists.
There's a good mix of work in it. I mean, there are three video pieces. Sarjevich, there's one piece as one comes in, which is basically it's a nice piece. It's 10 minutes, and he starts off driving a motor car, and the reverse happens as he drives. The windscreen becomes misted, unlike the opposite when we start off in the morning. Well, we're driving, so it becomes misted, and he draws on the windscreen and a grid like pattern, and it's a very simple piece. But it's very, very enjoyable, and it relates to some of his digital print work as well that's on the wall. So it's actually quite an interesting piece. And there are two video pieces at the end by Matt Mulligan.
Oh,
yeah,
brilliant.
And those ones, one is entitled it's The Breakfast, and the other one, well, it's the shortened version, and the other one is basically the noises that a sink emptying makes and how you can control
it. It sounds fascinating.
Matt Mulligan's
and it adds to the mystery. Many thanks to Jesse Jones and art collector Tom Honan for going along to see the Secret Theory of Drawing exhibition, which is on at the Model Arts and Nyland Gallery in Sligo on the 18th of March 2007. You're listening to The 11th Hour with me, Pádraic Branagh. It could be said that palliative care and the work of the hospice community in Ireland has been little represented in contemporary culture. The Hospice, a new four-part documentary series for RTE Television, is attempting to readdress that issue. Director Alan Gilsonen gained unlimited access to St Francis Hospice in Raheny in Dublin to tell us the stories of some of those living with terminal illness. Joining me to discuss the series is playwright Vincent Woods and Stephanie McBride, who's a lecturer in visual culture at Dublin City University. Before we talk about the hospice, let's hear a piece from the first episode, which is screened tonight on RTE One Television.
St Francis Hospice, good morning. Hospice care is care for the terminally ill. A system of care that attempts to address the physical, psychological, social and spiritual needs of both patient and family.
The ethos of St Francis Hospice, I would say, is dignity, respect and compassion. Patients who come to us may be at the end stage of their lives, but I think it's obvious from what we see here every day that patients are living to the end. They may have one day left in their lives, but they will live it to the end. And I think that's an important aspect for us, and it's what hospice is about, and that hospice very much treats the patient and the family as the one unit.
And that was Chief Executive of St Francis Hospice, Ethel McKenna. Vincent Woods, a difficult subject matter for a four-part series. How is it handled?
I think it was handled very sensitively. It's a very important subject and very difficult one, as you say. I think it makes for bleak viewing, inevitably. But that bleakness is tempered with a great deal of, not exactly hope, but certainly a great testimony to the human spirit and how the human spirit can rise through even that bleakness of the inevitability of death. It looked at the lives of 10 people who are in hospice care in St Francis in Raheny. A mixture of ages from a young mother of 36 to much older people. And all of their stories were moving and real. They had very different approaches to their inevitable deaths, from anger and rage and non-belief in any afterlife to a sort of acceptance and resignation and belief. But I think overall the series is very well made. It's sensitive. It steers a very fine line. It could have been voyeuristic. It could have almost have been prurient in a way, in terms of illness. But I think it kept to the correct side of sensitivity, and allowed people to tell their own stories. And in that, I think it was very impressive. Its simplicity was very effective, and it never strayed into anything that was insensitive.
Stephanie McBride, did it give us a comprehensive view of what happens in a hospice?
Well, I think it's the emphasis was actually on the people who were facing death, although you did have access to the people, and indeed there was some footage of those people who were caring for them. I think the emphasis, quite rightly, was actually on those individuals who were caught up in rage and resilient and facing death. And I think there's actually another story to be told in terms of those who care for them. Although they were present in the hospice series, nonetheless, I think rightly Alan Gilsonen's film drew us into the different worlds of the various individuals. And I think it's important because in terms of television and amid all the kind of reality TV, amid the whole sort of makeovers and pushovers, we need quiet television like this. I think it was intimate. It was allowing us to listen, a space to listen to those very eloquent and very courageous and very honest voices of those people. And I was reminded actually too, because you know, it's there in the television schedule, as I think you were saying, you're not so sure you would have perhaps chosen to watch it. But I think it's also part of the whole being caught up in the glare and the barrage and the din of the Celtic Tiger consumerism, that in fact, you know, it is a role for public service broadcasting to, as it were, bring that kind of subject matter to our attention and to make the space for it. And I was reminded, although in a very different capacity, of the HBO series 6 Feet Under, which in a very different way, a very different drama, but again it was putting, you know, the realities of death and bereavement and confronting them and challenging them rather than tidying them away or sort of tidying them away or hiding them for reasons of social nicety and convenience. And I think to the individuals in this programme, whether it was the young woman who was, you know, so angry that this would happen to her and how could it happen to a mother of two beautiful young children, or indeed, you know, the kind of small joys that people clung on to, whether it was there was one woman whose last trip to Lourdes was also made available to us, and she was shown enjoying an ice cream sundae.
Or the gentleman that loved the music.
Or the gentleman who loved, I think it was Rossini. But it's all the way in which, you know, faced with the inevitable, which of course we shy away from and are in denial about, there is an extraordinary sense of just resilience of the human, I think you said, the human spirit. And I was reminded too of some of the listeners may remember seeing The Blossom, which was Dennis Potter's last interview with Melvyn Bragg, when he talked about when he was first diagnosed with cancer, how he says, you know, you just recognise that we're very odd human beings. Despite the certainty of death, we continue to pay our taxes, he said. We continue to go on working as if there's some sort of eternity. And he said there was a kind of serenity for him when he was diagnosed. And yet the most small details and small things in life became charged with significance, so that the blossom outside became more intense and more charged with sort of purity and intensity. And you did get that sense too from the people who again allowed us access to those very private, intimate moments in the piece, so that I don't know if it's an accurate picture. I wasn't actually looking for an accurate picture of what happens in a hospice, but I felt the whole sort of honesty and eloquence of the people on camera coming through and made available.
But who's going to be looking at this, Vincent? What would you, as you said, as you mentioned, personally, I would have found it difficult. It wouldn't be my first choice television.
I imagine for many people it wouldn't, but it is on it at a fairly prime time. So I think inevitably an audience will watch at least some of it. And I think if the series achieves nothing more than to make more people aware of the work of hospice, the extraordinary work of hospice, it will have achieved a great deal.
It hardly needs a four-part series to make a public service issue, as we mentioned.
No, but I think it does more than that as well. I think it actually allows the individuals in this case to give testimony and to leave something behind for their own families, for their friends, but also for a larger public who are watching, because there isn't a single family in Ireland who isn't affected by cancer.
Slightly difficult, because one of the people in the mother with the young children said she's tried to make a video recording of her life, she's tried to write a diary of her life for her children, and every time she opens the book, she cries.
That's right, I think this series allowed her to do what she couldn't do herself, because the hospice does make this facility available to families.
I think, in fact, it's important that it's four parts. I think it's important that it wasn't, as it were, wrapped up in 1 hour, an episode of 1 hour. I think it's important because you do get a sense of these stories as they were being told. There was a continuity as they move through the various stages. And I think that's important. It's too easy in our sort of 3-minute culture to wrap things up and dispatch. This is
important.
But no,
they're not part of our culture as well, to sort of look at car crashes and to watch the inevitability of these people going to die over 6 weeks for us or 4 weeks for us. Is that not something morbid and strange about that?
But they don't die over that period of time. Some may live for a year or 2 years.
But in our experience with them, they will die over the next 4 episodes.
No, not all of them do, I think. And I think that's the point about hospice, that some people are in hospice care for years. It's not about watching 10 people living and dying. It's actually about allowing 10 people to speak about their suffering,
so
but also
no,
about,
no moral
about whatever
here at all,
hope
Stephanie.
They may have.
I'm not so sure what the moral issue might be. I agree that it's important to give space to the people to speak, and I think it's also important that we're given that space to listen to those stories. And I think it's not just about the death, it's actually the approaches to death. It's extraordinary, you know, how humbling it is to listen to the, you know, the various experiences that are coming through there. And I was interested too that I think you said earlier that Alan Gilson was given access all areas or unlimited access, and yet there are times, you know, he chose not to film. For example, there was the very highly charged emotional reunion of estranged members of a family. Now, while we had the very important meetings prior to that to arrange it, to make it the most valuable experience and worthwhile experience, nonetheless, the camera didn't follow it through in that. And I think there was a kind of restraint there. Nonetheless, what we were shown was the way in which all of those requests were facilitated. And I think you can't do that in a 3-minute culture. You know, you do have to give that space for people's anxieties to be given and their vulnerabilities to be given expression.
We see the staff, Vincent, we see them discussing this meeting, this gentleman that had with his estranged sons. They seem to be totally on top of the situation and a holistic approach to all the problems. There were counsellors, there were different therapists, and there was a whole backup there for the patients. That was really interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, and it struck me that there must be somebody there to counsel the counsellors, because I can't imagine that you could work in a hospice every day without experiencing enormous grief yourself at the experience of other people's grief. And I was so struck by the courage in the first place of the 10 people who bore testament to their own pain and the inevitability of their deaths, but then also to the staff of the hospice, the home care team, the counsellors, the nurses in the hospice, who work daily with people in pain, in grief, and with their families. And they're very impressive people. And again, I think many people may not know that hospice is a service that is available free. And that's quite
that's,
a striking
that,
feature.
That's something else that brings you up short, you know, when you're listening to them, you realise that this is free. In the current climate, that is so extraordinary and so important as well. I think too, While there's an emphasis to some extent on the staff, it is very much, I think, the individuals who are put to the fore in that. And I think, too, the way in which, you know, knowing Alan Gilson's work over time, and he's one of probably our most versatile in the way in which he works across different media and theatre and film, drama, documentary, it struck me, too, that there was a you could see it touched onto in his choice to have home movie footage at this point. And I think there, some of that is just heartbreaking when you see the scenes of holidays, happier days. And it's cut to, if I'm correct, I'm trying to remember, but it was cut to a Frank Sinatra song. And it just seems to me that it was just tugging there, not in any gratuitous, cheap way, but rather to draw you further in. And I think that that is the value of that kind of honest, intimate, poetic filmmaking.
It was, yeah, it was the truth of a life, you know, of lives and the variety of lives. That nobody's life is simple. Nobody's life can be reduced and told in a few minutes. And I think it allowed that kind of expansiveness, both in terms of images and that lovely detail, one of the women talking about how she clung to hope and having heard somebody on radio talking about the symbolism of a tiny white feather, and the next morning seeing a tiny white feather stuck to the window of the bathroom, and how she saw that as this little fragile sign of hope. That's and right. I found that very moving. Just that, and it was the woman who went to Lourdes, not, that's she right. said, for a cure or for prayer, but because she loved the Pyrenees, that's and she right. loved birds. So there's always this great humanity shining through in all the stories.
I think that's right. And I think, too, that the camera itself, while it's very intimate, it's not invasive in a curious way. And I think, too, that time and again, while there's that close-up on somebody who's ill in their sick bed, or whether they're telling their story and very, very vulnerable and indeed breaking down on camera, nonetheless, I don't feel that it was invasive or intrusive in that way. And yet, time and again, too, the camera was actually quite static at times in just picking out the interiors of this institution. And yet, despite the fact that it might be glancing through a glass panel and seeing activity elsewhere, you still had, despite its institutional furnishings, you still had that extraordinary sense of care, generosity of spirit.
Yeah, certainly. And also, Alan Gilson being a filmmaker, there was a beautiful quality to it. There were some beautiful shots, beautiful lighting. It was very well done.
It was, and there was always this feeling of trust between between the filmmaker and the people who were speaking, and the trust in him in terms of entrusting in a way their lives and part of their debts as testament to leave behind. I think it's a very important series.
Did we learn how to cope better with this from watching this? Or did it challenge us to look at it differently again?
I think that it's probably no harm that it arrests us in some way to think about those issues of death and bereavement and the you know, that I think at one point somebody says it's not just about medical care, it's about so many other aspects of coming to terms. And I think it does help in that respect, and I think it's important that it's four parts rather than any kind of easily wrapped up.
Will you, just a quick answer, will you watch all four?
Yes.
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you, Vincent Woods and Stephanie McBride, for reviewing The Hospice for us. The four-part series can be seen on Monday nights at 9:30 on RTÉ1 television. I hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the 11th Hour podcast. The 11th Hour is live on RTÉ Radio 1, Mondays to Fridays at 11 p.m. From me, Pádraig Branagh, and the rest of the team in the 11th Hour, Slán.